I remember the moment quite vividly. We had just left my family friend's house and were walking across the street to our parked car. We'd go over to our family friend's house every week or two, have dinner, enjoy each other's company. Our parents were friends with each other from way back, and the kids were about me and my sister's age. And as we approached the car, my sister, 2.5 years younger, maybe 7 or 8 at the time, turned to my dad and said, "You cannot drive us home." My dad looked at her a little confused. "Why?" "Because you've had alcohol." Alcohol wasn't a big part of my growing up. It wasn't even a weekly occurrence. It was a sometimes thing that my parents had with their friends, and on that specific night, I think my dad had had 2 beers over 6 hours and a meal. Not exactly the recipe for intoxicated driving, but the narrative of the way alcohol impacts our society was deep within us already as children. Don't drink and drive. Alcohol is dangerous. Could be in your family, too. Even though that last part, "it could be in your family, too," was there, it wasn't very present for me. I definitely thought about alcoholism and addiction as something that happened in other places. I, of course, encountered individuals who were inebriated on the street, and that also helped me think about addiction and intoxication as something that happened somewhere else. Not in my family, not in my situation. But when I was a chaplain at a hospital in Boston, one of the exercises we had to do was to chart out our family tree, figuring out how people were connected to each other, where the divorces were, where the marriages, the children, the people that don't talk to each other, the people that are kind of really closely connected, and also we had to chart who struggled with addiction in our family. And so I got on the phone and started to talk with my parents, and they helped me figure out all of this family tree because I didn't know it all. And then we got to the addiction question, and I assumed that there wasn't much of it, and then I learned that actually there was quite a bit of it, actually. And things started to make sense a little bit more, like how one of our relatives would always offer to take us places and do really fun and exciting things with us, and yet our parents never quite allowed it to happen. My mom said to me, "Yeah, we never wanted you to get into a car with this person. We were scared about what might happen." Addiction was here in my family. Last year, the UU publishing arm Skinner House put out this book. It's called Restored to Sanity: Essays on the 12 Steps by Unitarian Universalists. Each of the 12 steps has 2 or 3 essays from Unitarian Universalists who talk about their personal experience trying to live sobriety for whatever addiction they are struggling with. When it came out, I bought about 15 copies, and I kept it in my office. And each time someone in the congregation came to me, or I learned that they in their family or themselves had struggled with addiction or working through recovery and that the 12 steps were important to them, I would give them a copy of the book. I have 1 copy left. Addiction is here in this congregation. Earlier this week, I posted on Facebook, "I'm preaching on Sunday about addiction. What should I know?" 174 posts later, I'm serious. 174 posts later, I had heard the heart-rending stories of people in my life who have struggled with addiction, who have had family members struggle with addiction, who have had to figure out how to relate to a loved one in their destructiveness, how to set behavior boundaries and still love, about the many different ways people have found recovery, who have been impacted. Not to mention the countless private messages I got from individuals who wanted to tell me their story of addiction but didn't want it to be publicly known. Addiction is ever present. It is here in our world. And yet the interesting thing about addiction is that in some ways it is very hidden, or it is as hidden as we allow it to be. And I say that intentionally, that addiction is as hidden as we allow it to be, because there is such a shame and stigmatization around addiction. There is a shame that we or people we love struggle with this thing, this behavior, this substance use, which leads them to dangerous behavior for themselves and for other people. And there is a shame because the story we have heard implicitly is that those who struggle lack a certain moral character, a certain will, a certain weakness in who they are. This has been the societal story we've told about addiction for centuries, and even though modern science and psychology and even our own experiences in our families tell us how wrong it is, this shame of being afflicted or connected to someone who struggles with this is so strong. It remains hidden. It is also hidden because there is this smokescreen of stigmatization that exists. Because in our society's collective imagination, the caricature of those who are struggling with addiction are people on the margins, people who live close to poverty, who come from certain types of backgrounds, who may live or experience homelessness. Those are the types of people that struggle with addiction in our collective imagination, and this is a convenient, stigmatized smokescreen that makes it even more difficult to see the ways addiction goes across every part of our society. This smokescreen is made even more strong by the war on drugs and the incarceration of communities of color for drug-related crimes at even higher levels than any other communities, even though we know that drug use is pretty stable no matter your race. This stigma tells a story about addiction, about who has it and why. It whispers to us about moral failings or happening to those types of people, and it shields addiction from looking like it does, which is looking like us, like each of us. No matter our income, our family background, our past experiences, addiction looks like the people in this congregation as it does any other congregation. But it is hidden, hidden by shame, hidden by our imagining, hidden by this stigma, and this hiddenness prevents so many people from getting help because they don't want to be cast with that lot. So when addiction only looks one way, it's hard for us to see ourselves in the mirror. But addiction is here. Not just on the streets or in trailer parks. Addiction is in the suburbs, in office towers and ivory towers. It is here in Fort Collins, in every neighborhood, and it is, of course, here in this congregation. I invite you, if you are willing, to raise your hand if within your circle of friends or family members or even yourself, if you have been touched or impacted by addiction to drugs or alcohol. Look around. No matter how addiction touches your life, you are not alone. And yet, it remains so hidden. It is our dirty secret that we dare not speak about it. Even though 2/3 of families in this nation are intimately impacted by addiction, even though 23 million Americans are living in long-term recovery from substance addiction, these stories are often hidden. I've been struck by the invisible dimensions of the world of addiction, the invisibilizing that I just spoke about, the stigmatization, but also the inherent invisibility of the cause. Of course, we can point to, in the case of substance addiction, the bottles or the drugs or the thing that someone is consuming. But what makes someone reach for those in the first place is invisible much of the time. The biological, psychological, generational, spiritual, societal cocktail that seems to hijack the will, ruining self-control, leading someone down a path of choosing a substance over their own well-being, of choosing a substance over being able to be the person they want to be, of continuing a destructive behavior over the well-being of a partner or a child, there is an invisibilia, an unseen force of control that surrounds addiction that is hard for us to get our minds around. What is addiction really? Dr. Alice Miller asked. It's a sign, a signal, a symptom of distress. It is a language that tells us about a plight that we must understand, but understanding addiction is terribly complex. Understanding addiction, Dr. Gabor Mate says, is all about many things. He writes, addiction is a complex condition, a complex interaction between human beings and the environment, and we need to view it simultaneously from many different angles. Addiction has a biological, chemical, neurological, psychological, medical, emotional, social, political, economic, and spiritual underpinning, and perhaps, he says, I haven't thought about all of them. To get anywhere near a complete picture, we must keep shaking the kaleidoscope to see what other patterns emerge. And we have come a long way. As my colleague, the Reverend Ruth Reinhart, spoke about in a recent sermon on addiction, up until the late 19th century, addiction to alcohol was seen as a lack of willpower and a massive moral failing. It wasn't until Alcoholics Anonymous published their book in 1939 to great success that this 12-step model of recovery took hold that promoted this idea that alcoholism is a disease, a physical and mental and spiritual disease that cannot be cured but can be arrested by the working of the 12 steps. It wasn't, in fact, till 1956 when the American Medical Association, although they didn't declare alcoholism a disease, decided to recognize for the first time that alcoholics were legitimate patients. 1956. Hospitals, they said, should be urged to consider admission of such patients with a diagnosis of alcoholism based upon the conditions of the individual patient rather than a general objection to all such patients. 1956. Since then, we have learned a lot about addiction, about how addiction rewires the brain, forming certain types of neural synapses and other sciencey things that I'm forgetting how to say right now. By taking advantage of the brain's marvelous plasticity, this guy says, addiction remolds neural circuits to assign supreme value to a certain thing, to a behavior or a substance of cocaine or heroin or gin at the expense of other interests such as health, work, families, or life. In fact, the brain of someone who is struggling with addiction is fundamentally different than someone who is not. In a sense, Antonelle Bottini, addiction is a pathological form of learning. We've also learned that addiction is passed down genetically. We have learned that addiction impairs someone's field of attention, narrowing it to a specific substance in a specific situation where other concerns are very hard to even bring one's attention to. We've learned that addiction is a rewiring of who we are, but also it is a response to trauma and pain and stress. It is a response to a feeling of inadequacy, of having a hole inside of you, of not feeling like you could ever be enough or even be present to your life. We've learned that addiction is not just about substance, but also about behaviors and practices. We've learned a lot about addiction in the last 60 years, but despite this, we truly don't know the full picture. Many of us in our own relationships with addiction have glimmers of understanding, caught up in a sea of unknowing. And we are constantly shaking that kaleidoscope to try to figure out what's truly at stake. We don't truly know what causes it, but we do know the deep, destructive presence it has in our lives. And so I offer two ways of thinking about addiction that have been helping me in these past few days as I've been trying to understand addiction. One comes from Ann Wilson Schleff, who is a psychologist and renowned speaker. She says that each person, every single person, has at least one addiction. and it has a lot to do with society's dysfunction and demands. She writes, "We live in a society that demands addiction. The person who is best adjusted to this society is not dead and not alive, because if you were fully alive, you couldn't support the system that is going on. When you are fully alive, you're constantly saying no to many of the processes of society, the racism, the environmental destruction, the nuclear threat, the arms race, drinking unsafe water, living up to societal standards. This saying no is hard. And thus it is in the interest of society to promote those things that take that edge off, to keep us busy with our fixes and keep us slightly numbed out or zombie-like. In this way," she says, "our modern consumer society itself functions as an addiction." That was helpful to me. It was also helpful for me to hear about psychologist Scott Peake, who speaks from a Christian's perspective, but we'll help translate this together. In a 1991 lecture entitled "Addiction, the Sacred Disease," he says, "At births, humans become separated from God," and so we'll translate to say God or belovedness or interconnection or love, "and that everyone is aware of this separation, but some people are more attuned to it than others. They report feeling an emptiness, a longing, what many refer to as a hole in their soul. They sense that something is missing and don't know what, and that at some point in their lives, often quite young, because we know addiction usually occurs or first surfaces between the ages of 13 and 21, at some time in their life, these sensitive souls stumble across something that makes them feel better. For some, it's alcohol. For others, it's sugar, drugs, shopping, sex, work, gambling, or some other substance or activity that hits the spot. Ah," they sigh, "I've found what's been missing. This is the answer to my problems. They've discovered a new best friend, a drug of choice." What we humans really long for, he continued, is a connection to God. So we'll say a connection to belovedness, a connection to belonging, a connection to all that is, a feeling of wholeness. And it is in that deep spiritual hunger, this longing to be a part of it, to feel whole, that we get confused about what we're really hungry for, so we go looking for love in all the wrong places. A bottle of booze, pills, a cookie jar, a casino, shopping malls, a pack of smokes, the internet. We reach for anything that will take the edge off, to smooth out life's rough spots, to help us make it through the night. Now, I am no expert on addiction. I believe, as with most human realities, there exists a complexity beyond our full knowing, and we are taking deep steps, both through scientific endeavor, but also through the testimony of those who have lived with certain addictions. And so I offer these as humble suggestions about what might help us go forward. First is, I think we need to break the silence and the stigma about addiction. I was heartened to learn that in the 1870s, a new alcoholic mutual aid society called the Ribbon Reform Club was started in the northeast of the U.S. Their members wore colored ribbons on their clothing so that they could recognize one another and convey to each other a message of hope about recovery to each other, but also to the larger community. I thought that was pretty powerful. I think it's pretty powerful to think about how each of us can come out about the ways addiction has touched our lives, because most of you have these stories. And yet, if we do not speak about them, there is no space in our public discourse for stories of both recovery and addiction, and thus we feel isolated and disconnected from any possibilities of change or connection. I think we also need to affirm that recovery looks many different ways. For some, the 12-step process pioneered by Alcoholics Anonymous is a process that connects them to a devoted, caring, and accountable community that has its own language and way of being that helps them through and cope with their addiction. But for others, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step process does not work. And so we need to affirm that there are many ways to deal with these struggles, that they don't all look like we might want them to. I also think we need to evaluate our own relationships with substances and behaviors. I mean, we live in Fort Collins. How many breweries do we have? We live in Colorado. How many dispensaries do we have? As I learned in my mental health first aid course, Substance use disorder occurs when the recurrent use of alcohol or drugs causes significant impairment, such as health problems, disability, and the failure to meet major responsibilities at work, school, or at home. It is not about how much you consume, it is about what the consuming does to you. That was helpful to me. I've printed off a few copies of the Mental Health First Aid Guide on Substance Use Disorder. It's at the welcome table. Know that there is support for you if you are ready for it, or family members who are struggling, that you have inherent worth no matter what is going on. And finally, I think we need to seriously consider thinking about our relationships with those who are struggling with addiction. As UU Minister Seth Fisher, who is in recovery, says, when it comes to relationship with addicts, it's important to A, never give up hope, and B, never harm your own health and sanity and get dragged down in someone else's addiction. Taking to heart that we cannot change anyone else, that it is their work, but knowing that you are not alone as you struggle to be in relationship with someone who is struggling with addiction and that it is not your fault is important for us to say to each other over and over again. I think there should be a disclaimer that comes with every sermon that says this sermon is inherently inadequate. And so I leave you with that thought and my hope that together we can face this very real and human struggle with less and less inadequate responses, and that the first step forward is speaking about it, understanding and getting the bearings, making visible what has been pushed down, and knowing that we don't do it alone. Amen.